This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch the show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. When faced with the existential crises of global warming and nuclear annihilation, politicians often speak in terms of transitioning away from the causes of the crises. And these are the liberal politicians. It is assumed that human beings cannot handle abrupt changes even in the face of certain destruction. Why is that? Is it human nature? Or is it the very definition of human nature that's the problem? My guest is Judith Deutsch. She is a columnist for Canadian Dimension magazine, former president of Science for Peace, and a psychoanalyst by profession. She currently heads the Militarism Working Group and is active in Palestinian solidarity work and other social justice issues. She recently wrote an article in Counterpunch entitled "Convenient Untruths About Human Nature: Can People Deal with Climate Change and Nuclear Weapons?" Welcome to the program, Judith.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about where our ideas of human nature come from. Who are the scientists? Which are the scientists that are working to understand human nature? You know, we've had an ages-old debate about what it is that impacts and influences human beings, nature versus nurture, et cetera. Is it the psychoanalysts like yourself that deal with these questions?
I think that the views of human nature, well, I mean, there's a big background, I think, in terms of underlying views that come from liberalism, the philosophy of liberalism. I think the current views have come very much from the 1970s, approximately at that time. You know, the growth from two different directions. One is the management paradigms with the business schools and economics, and the other comes from the biological sciences.
And basically, is this the broadly speaking idea of Darwinism, that human beings simply react based on what they think is going to be important for their immediate survival?
I hadn't really thought that much in terms of Darwinism, because that's so much often connected with social Darwinism and survival of the fittest and that kind of thing. But more from almost the tradition from Locke and John Stuart Mill. You know, it's an emphasis on individualism, in its most progressive way, individual liberty. But it's like the view that, people are kind of self-forming, that they don't arise out of relationships, you know, that the idea of in a sense of the blank screen and so on. Although, I mean, that's inconsistent with a lot of neuroscience findings, but it's still the view that there's something inside the brain, inside each individual, that determines who they are, that it doesn't arise out of, you know, very complex interactions with people. And
we certainly do see, and many of us feel, overwhelming helplessness often, right? When we are faced with the facts about climate change, how fast our Earth is warming, when we really start to think about how many nuclear weapons there are and how even one small mistake could trigger mass death. And in the age of Donald Trump, when we think about 4 years of a madman at the helm of the government, you know, I get the sense that there's a tendency to look away sometimes and deny what's really happening. But how do humans generally handle these huge crises that threaten their very existence?
I've wondered about or struggled with that for a long time. I have have had a lot of experience, you know, with a number of political issues, but also my individual clinical work, you know, with children and with adults. And my impression, the articles that I wrote, I quoted a Native First Nations person here in Canada who really challenges the idea that people really know. And I don't think that they do. I don't think that people really are knowledgeable about the nuclear weapons situation, you know, in terms of the North American or even the European public, or about climate change. I think when people are really faced with urgent matters and emergencies and crises, that there's the potential, and often, you see it, the people can become very focused, and work very, very closely together and to very realistically grapple with the situation.
So it's a lack of enough information. So for example, when we hear about a politician like Barack Obama, liberal Democrat, wanting to talk about transitioning away from fossil fuels and looking at, say, fracked oil and gas as a transition energy source, because the assumption is that we cannot, as a species, handle an abrupt transition away from fossil fuels. Is that disingenuous of somebody like Obama, who could instead face us with the dire facts about climate change to justify abrupt switching over?
Exactly. I think it's a political issue, not a psychological issue. It's interesting that since the 1960s, actually, Lyndon Baines Johnson gave a in one of his State of the Union messages, talked about transitioning to renewables. So this idea of transition, is extraordinarily irresponsible and vague, by this time. Emissions are worse. There's an acceleration of temperature change as well as concentration of greenhouse gases. But there's so much, distortion already in this because, for one, renewables, have been almost the single way of people have talked about dealing with it. So in a sense, it's business as usual until we switch to renewables. So there's no thought, like if there's an emergency, one can think of a whole range of things. For example, aviation, international aviation and shipping were exempt and are exempt still under Kyoto, although it's considered to be it's optional whether it's included in emissions. Well, if it's considered to be an emergency, then one would substantially cut international aviation, because that would, even without having to invent a new technology or anything like that, that would substantially already cut
So
emissions.
political responses to existential crises are much more based on the bottom line of corporations, on the preservation of neoliberal economic systems, than they are on a flawed idea that human beings can't handle abrupt transitions.
Absolutely.
How do
And
we
the more you
then?
think about it, the worse it gets.
Go ahead.
I was thinking, like, with the example with aviation, George Monbiot, a number of years ago, wrote an excellent article on the Stern Report, where he rationalizes expanding aviation, for instance, because because a rich person, a very wealthy person, would lose more money by having to wait for a flight. And so that it's the cost of human lives someplace on the planet compared to how much money, this very wealthy person could lose by having to wait, So there's plans all over the world to substantially increase aviation at this time. And aviation isn't going to be served by renewables. They won't be able to use renewables.
You
So
can't fly a plane by putting solar panels on it.
absolutely not. And there's some talk now of using biofuels, but that, has caused destruction of tropical rainforests, and it's emitting in itself. And it also has caused the incredible increase in food prices, and it robs land from farming for food. So it's a terrible solution.
So how can we address existential crises, knowing that it is imperative that we can't let the politicians and the corporate CEOs make the decisions? It does feel overwhelming. It does feel like, looking away and thinking about tomorrow rather than 10 years from now is easier.
Well, for one, I think at the center of it has to be faced that this is a human emergency, and that, as I indicated in my paper, which is based more on a psychoanalytic psychology, is that I think, you know, many people are really quite capable, you know, that that's what maturity is about, is being able to be responsible and to be responsible towards other people. And I think that the so-called solutions would become more apparent when it's perceived, you know, as an emergency. And there's many, many examples of that, you know, of people working very, very hard, working very, very much together in a community to, you know, to save people. You know, those were the responses in Hurricane Katrina. It was the initial response in the Haiti earthquake where people, you know, helped themselves. And there's the article that you had, I think that you've alluded to, you know, like the people who saved this river, you know?
Yes, in fact, let's talk about that. A very interesting story in Kerala, India, in South India, where 700 women, or hundreds of women, almost all women, revived a dead river that had been destroyed through years of industrialization and pollution. And they physically put themselves in harm's way and spent in about 70 days physically clearing and cleaning the river and brought it back to life. And so they were able to see that their own future well-being was dependent on some short-term pain. And in the face of political inaction, they did something about it. That's a pretty amazing story. And I think probably human history is littered with stories like that, even though it is sadly littered with stories of us being the root of our own undoing. I mean, Easter Island, for example, and you can probably find stories on both sides.
As you say, there are innumerable good stories. There's the Cuba, you know, in the reaction to in the 1990s to the loss of the, you know, its you know, the its relationship with the Soviet Union, and they had to completely change their economy. They had, you know, people were starving, so they revised their agriculture. And that's one thing that has to be revised worldwide now. You know, the agribusiness, industrial agriculture, is a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions that will be totally untouched by renewables. But it's estimated that anywhere between 15 and 50% of emissions come from, you know, the life cycle of agriculture now.
So finally, let's also talk about the Trump situation and how you think people can, you know, start to rethink issues of climate change and nuclear weapons, you know, both of which Trump is going to exacerbate, how we can sort of rethink this as an emergency. Because I think you're right, when we are faced with very immediate and clear-cut impacts of devastation, we do act. And unfortunately, it takes us thinking in terms of those things to act. If a glacier melts far away from us and we don't see it, does it really melt, right? We don't really see it as enough of an emergency. What are some things that people can arm themselves with? I mean, obviously, political organizing is our only path forward, right?
Absolutely. But I think that it has to be much better informed. A couple of years ago, I was in a health tribunal in Guatemala looking at the mining, you know, some of the mining companies and impacts there. And there were people there, you know, young people who knew exactly what was going on, both in terms of mining and climate change. And I don't think that that's true again here. I think there has to be a very concerted effort to come up to snuff in a way and to be much better educated, both with regard to nuclear weapons as well as the climate. You know, the climate is a system. So the glacier is melting someplace else. By this time, you know, what I think scientists, the most productive things that they're discovering are the actual mechanisms, you know, how it works as a system. So, you know, the glaciers melting affect, you know, stratification and ocean circulation. They affect the Gulf Stream and the jet stream. So it's so massive. And these are changes that occurred at half the temperature change, you know, that we're seeing now. So the extent of the change, you know, I think people have to understand that. And unfortunately, you know, it's for some reason, And I place some of the responsibility at, with educators, is that they're not, they're not really understanding it or taking it on. And, of course, that can have to do with the structure of universities and so on now. But I think, again, coming back to some example of Cuba, where, with the people faced with this, starving population, is that every department was shifted to deal with the emergency, and I think that it's that kind of thing that has to take place now. An example of the, the neglect in a way of this area is I taught a class at the University of Toronto, which is reputed to have one of the best university libraries in North America. And to date, they only have two copies of James Hansen's book, Storms of My Grandchildren, which is probably the best book in a way explaining the entire, how the climate system works. So he, I think the book was published 2009 or something. So it took a couple of years for the library to even have one copy of the book. And that was at the theology library. And the second one appeared in the humanities library.
Wow.
But they have many, many copies of James Lovelock, and many, many copies of Bjørn Lomborg, who essentially is a, a climate change denier to some extent. And Lovelock's, Gaia theory, I mean, he's a quaint kind of person. I mean, he seems like that, but nonetheless, he's talking about Earth being, sustainable only for, several million people at most. So, right off the bat, he's disposing of 5 billion people. Why would you listen to somebody like that?
Right.
And yet
And
they
of
have.
course, we also need to talk about the media if we're talking about public education, with the New York Times recently coming under fire for hiring a columnist who's basically a climate change denialist. Well, Judith, we'll post a link to your Counterpunch article from our website later today. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and discussing these issues.
Okay, well, thank you very much for giving me the chance.
Thank you. Judith Deutsch is a columnist for Canadian Dimension Magazine, former president of Science for Peace, a psychoanalyst. She currently heads a militarism working group and is active in Palestinian solidarity work and other social justice issues. Her article in Counterpunch is entitled Convenient Untruths About Human Nature: Can People Deal with Climate Change and Nuclear Weapons? I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.